Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. For the first time, award-winning investigative journalist M. William Phelps reveals the identity of Raven, the serial killer who co-starred with him on Dark Minds, and tells the story of his intriguing bond with one of America's most disturbing killers. In September 2011, M. William Phelps made a bold decision that would change the landscape of reality-based television and his own life. He asked a convicted serial killer to act as a consultant for his TV series. Under the codename Raven, the murderer shared his insights into the minds of other killers and helped analyze their crimes. As the series became an international sensation, Raven became Phelps' unlikely confidant, ally, and friend. In this deeply personal account, Phelps traces his own family's dark history and takes us into the heart and soul of a serial murderer. He also chronicles the complex relationship he developed with Raven, from questions about morality to Raven's thoughts on the still unsolved brutal murder of Phelps' sister-in-law. The author found himself grappling with an unwanted, unexpected, unsettling connection with a cold-blooded killer. Drawing on over 7,000 pages of letters, dozens of hours of recorded conversations, personal and Skype visits, and a friendship 5 years in the making, Phelps sheds new light on Raven's bloody history, including details of an unknown victim, the location of a still-buried body, and a jaw-dropping admission. Eye-opening and provocative, Dangerous Ground is an unforgettable journey into the mind of a charming, manipulative psychopath that few would dare to know, and the determined journalist who did just that. The book that we're featuring this evening is Dangerous Ground, My Friendship with a Serial Killer, with journalist and author and television producer M. William Phelps. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, M. William Phelps.
Dan, how you doing? Thank you. Call me Matthew. Good to be back.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for joining us once again. This, I've called it one of your, if not your most important book, just incredible journey you are going to take us on this evening, as you have taken me in reading of this book, Dangerous Ground. You talk about this book being somewhat of a hybrid. So tell us why this is a hybrid, and in what way is it a mix of styles of true crime and memoir?
Well, yeah, it's a hybrid because, I never set out to write this book. This book kind of developed as I got to know Raven, a.k.a. Keith Jesperson, the Happy Face Killer, better and better. And I realized that having access to a serial killer such as Jesperson, who trusted me 100%, that I could ask him anything I wanted. So over the course of many years, you know, I interviewed him, and it kind of just grew into this collection of information that I needed to do something with. And so what do I do with it? And what I decided was, ever since Dark Minds started airing on ID in 2011, I believe it started, people have been asking me about my sister-in-law's case, and, she was 5 months pregnant. She was 36 years old. She was strangled to death with a pillowcase over her head, telephone cord around her neck. And my brother subsequently died several years later. And people have been asking me about that story. Always ask me how I got into true crime writing, my journey. And people ask me my own story. So I figured this was a great opportunity to tell all those stories and kind of use Jesperson's story as the backdrop for it. So the first section of the book is called Friends. The second section is called Family. And the third section is called faith. And, you know, the friends is a loose term, but, you know, I talk about our relationship there. And in the middle, I talk about his family, his background, him as a child, and me as a child, that we go back and forth. And then the end is faith. It's how I lost faith and how he has had faith in me to tell his story.
Now, you talk about first contacting him in September 2011. So tell
right.
us just a little bit about how you wrote him, what you included in that to convince him, and what was his response. Tell us a little bit about that correspondence initially.
Well, it started when the first season of Dark Minds, we had a killer on the show that we referred to as 13. That was his code name. And that guy was not Raven. He was not Jesperson. He was another guy that I won't name because it's not my guy, if you will. It's John Kelly. John Kelly's my forensic psychologist that was on the show with me, and that was his guy. Well, at the end of that season, Kelly says, you should develop your own guy, you know. And so in late 2010, I started writing to different serial killers, and John Kelly's the one who suggested, really, Jesperson, Joel Rifkin, a couple others, and I wrote to these guys, and I began to get letters back. And Jesperson just struck me as the kind of guy who wanted to talk and talk and talk, and the kind of guy who really wanted to impress me. He knew my work, he had read my work, and he was impressed by what I had done. He really respected me as a writer. And I started to receive, you know, an abundance of letters from him. And then we started talking on the phone, and I realized right away that, you know, he's the guy we need for the show.
Now, there was two things going on, though, in that you had him as a consultant on the show Dark Minds. And
right.
tell us what his role was in terms of that. Involved with the series, for those that didn't see it, but also what was unfolding beyond that or besides that at the same
sure.
time?
Well, Dark Minds is, the way it was pitched is Silence of the Lambs meets Catch Me If You Can. And what that means is when I created the show, I wanted to look at unsolved serial killer cases. There's many unsolved serial killer cases throughout the United States, so Zodiac being one of the most famous, you know, the original Night Stalker case down in California, the Texas killing fields, Florida. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And I wanted to look at those cases and bring some exposure to those cases, because a lot of those cases are just collecting dust. And so the way I designed the show was I go out, I investigate, I do my own work, I interview cops, I interview family members of the victims and so forth. But then I go back to John Kelly, my forensic psychologist, and kind of build a profile with him of the guy we might be looking for, the unsub, as we call them, and unidentified subject. And then we go to a serial killer on the phone. We don't expose who he is. We disguise his voice, and we get his opinion after I sent him the case that I'm looking at that particular week, that particular episode. And the way I've explained it is, it's no different, really, than using Phil Simms from the New York Giants to comment on the Giants game on Sunday on CBS. I mean, it's really the same concept. You know, you're going to an expert in the field for expert analysis of what you're doing, and there's no better expert to qualified to help you catch a serial killer than a serial killer. So that's the premise of the show. And for your listeners, you can go to YouTube and just Google Dark Minds and come up with probably 15 of the 22 episodes we filmed. And you'll hear Raven. And you know, so I would ask him, you know, to give you an example, Dan, I would say, you know, I'd send him information about a killer and a case, and he'd look at the victims, he'd look at the way the bodies were found, he'd look at all the everything, and he'd relate it back to his own mind and what he would do in this certain situation, and he'd give that analysis, and it helped. I believe it helped.
Now, you talk about this, the incredible amount of letters and pages of letters and the numerous calls, and there was phone calls
yeah.
so many that at certain times you did not answer them, but over this five-year period. But tell us about your visit at the Oregon State Penitentiary in 2012.
Yeah, the first time I went out and seen him, for many reasons, it was a devastating experience in many ways. And talking to him for about a year by then, he had been consulting on dark minds. He had written so many letters to me, I couldn't even tell you how many during that year. More than 7,000 pages over the course of the 5 years I received from him as far as letters go. I have probably 50 or 60 letters right now sitting on my desk in my office that are unopened that I can't keep up with the guy.
Amazing.
So I went out there and I was with my crew from Dark Minds. We were actually shooting in Oregon at the time. And I went out there and I sat with him and he's a massive man. I mean, he's 6'7". At the time, he was over 300 pounds. And, you know, we sat chair to chair. And, I mean, inches away from each other. And I sat, and I'm a pretty solid guy. I'm a big guy. And, you know, he was just massive. And he's sitting there in front of me. And his two hands were on his knees. And his hands were maybe, I don't know, 18 inches away from me. And the first thought I had was, those are the same hands that strangled 8 women, you know, and here they are just inches away from my own throat. So I said to him, I called him Raven or Jesperson. I said, could you kill me? Could you kill me? Because at this time we had become, he had begun to really start to trust me. I was his confidant. I mean, he really, really liked me at this time, a year into it. And he said, if I had to, he said, I wouldn't want to, but if I had to, I could easily kill you if you were in the way. And so, you know, thus began our personal relationship there, physical. We were right in front of each other, and we just began to talk, and I began to just develop him as a source. And what was the devastating part about the day was not only everything he said, but when I left there. I left the prison kind of in a daze, you know. And so me and my crew, we go down the street, we go to the Kinko's, we go to the coffee shop, and someone broke into our vehicle and stole my bag. And I got stuck in Oregon. We were on our way to Vancouver. It was a nightmare. It just turned into a nightmare. And really, Dan, it goes back to something John Kelly, my forensic psychologist, warned me about before I embarked on this journey. Because John Kelly had been talking to serial killers for many, many years. John Wayne Gacy, many, many famous serial killers he'd interviewed. And he said to me, he said, Matt, listen, he said, you're a tough guy, you know. You're strong, you're solid, you're a Catholic. I mean, you not only are you Catholic, but you go to Mass 4 or 5 times a week. You think you got control of everything. You've written 30 books about murderers. You've written 6, 7 books about serial killers. He said, but let me tell you something. He said, if the devil knocks on your door and you let him in, you better be ready to dance with him. Because if you're not, he's going to get inside your head. And I kind of laughed at Kelly in my own little funny way that we joke around. And I said, come on, Kelly, you're talking about Phelps, man. I'm tough. I'm rock solid. No one's going to crack me. But boy, you read that book, Dan. And he broke me. Raven broke me.
You talk about that, but it's a big process. And as John Kelly warned you, is to not let your guard down. And part of that, you believed, in not letting your guard down was to keep your personal life to yourself.
Right.
How was it then that you did share this stuff? How, explain, as you do in the book, the process that those lines get, the professional lines and the personal lines get blurred, as they did.
It's, you know, the metaphor that just came out of me while I started doing this media tour is that, you know, I live in Connecticut, so the coastline, is the water, whether it's August or July or September, the water's freezing. It's 60 degrees. You jump in that ocean water and it's 60 degrees and it's jarring, it shocks your body. But you know what happens? After you stay in it a while, you get used to it. Now,
right.
The temperature of the water has not changed You've just gotten used to it. And so, yeah. So this is what happened over the course of the time. I mean, I was talking to this guy, Happy Face, so much. I was reading his letters. And at one time, the prison decides, okay, you guys want to start Skyping, you're welcome to do that. So we start Skyping. So this guy has infected every part of my life. And, you know, here's an example. Here's a small example. Because Kelly always told me, John Kelly, said, Matt, he said, when you pick up that phone, be ready psychologically. You always have to be M. William Phelps when you pick up that phone. You can never be Matthew. He calls me Matthew. You can never be that guy, that husband, that father. You can't be that guy. You got to be M. William Phelps. So here's an example of how it would go. We'd be talking and talking about, you know, all these clinical things, these serial killer stuff, and I'd say, listen, man, I got to go. My daughter's got a volleyball game. I'll talk to you tomorrow or next week or whatever. Bang, hang up. And I'd stop and I'd say, phew, I slipped. Because the next time I would talk to him, this is how the conversation would begin. How did that volleyball game turn out with your daughter? And I'd get pissed. And I'd say, listen, man, you don't have the right to ask me about my personal life. And he'd say, well, you invited it. You know, you mentioned it. So I just thought it was okay. So little things like that begin to slip. And then you begin, you know, it slips farther and farther until you realize it. So that's how that went.
You talk about the first year or more of the one issue that Raven harps about and wants you to do his bidding in regards to reexamining or reinvestigating this. So tell us what he wants you to do about Tynina Bennett and what you do end up doing on his behalf.
So one of the things he banged on about, I mean, obsessively. I mean, he must have wrote 1,000 pages about the case. He, in the hundreds of hours of audio that I have recorded, a third, is about Tynina Bennett. And Tynina Bennett was his first murder in the state of Oregon. His first murder overall. It happened in Portland. And what happens is with Tynina Bennett is in 1990, he kills Tynina Bennett, dumps her body like near the Vista House outside of Portland, and two people are subsequently arrested for that murder, tried, and convicted while he is now becoming the serial killer. So he's watching this process unfold as he's killing other people, other women. He sees two people and put in prison for a murder he committed. And he's, at first he's laughing about it, it's funny, and wow, I've gotten away with it. Not only have I gotten away with it, but two people are in prison. And then we fast forward to, I think it's 1996, and he's arrested, he's put in prison for life, and he's in his cell, and an article comes out in the L.A. Times, a big, huge article. I mean, I don't know how many words it was, but it's 11 pages long or something, internet pages long, by Barry Siegel, I believe, big-time journalist, big-time article about Happy Face and this Tynina Bennett case and how two people could be wrongly convicted of this crime. And Jesperson reads this article, and he gets he claims he has an epiphany that, oh, my God, not only were two people convicted and tried and convicted and put away, but I believe the prosecutor and the cops knew that they had the wrong people and they still prosecuted them anyway. And if there's one thing about Jesperson that he is obsessive about, it's the fact that he's admitted his wrongs, so everybody else must cough up and admit their wrongs. And if they don't, he's going to do it for them. So he wanted me to reinvestigate the entire Bennett case and write about it and in proof that they knew, that the cops knew and that the prosecutor knew they had the wrong people, but they went ahead with it anyway. And his contention at the time was, oh, the cops fed them information in order for them to know certain details about the murder. But the cops knew that they were not the right people. So I said, okay. I said, you know, I'll give you that promise. I don't have to promise you anything, but I promise that I'll look into that, and I will write about my findings. Whatever they are, be prepared for what I find. And so thus I looked into it. I began to re-interview most of the people involved and look at the case, and, you know, I came to a conclusion.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you talk about, other than the Dark Minds consultation, because that ends, as you write about, in 3 years, and there's not a fourth season. You don't tell them right away that there isn't this fourth season. Tell us why, but what are your other plans to do with this correspondence? What else will you do with this correspondence?
Well, yeah, it was a tightrope for me, knowing that, well, first of all, I should say that the show was so personal to me. The show was beginning to make strides in cold cases. It was a one-of-a-kind show. My work through the show has created three task forces to reinvestigate some of these serial killer cases. And
right.
And not only that, but not you have 20 something cases that are reopened that were just collecting dust. That's good work. And I wrote in Dangerous Ground, in my book, it was like a death to me when they canceled that show. I mean, the general manager of ID is the one who broke the news to me, because he knew how hard it was going to be. All shows are ultimately canceled, but I felt that I had more work to do. Nonetheless, I get over that, and I think to myself, I can't tell him. I got to keep him going because I need his help. I need his help on many different levels. And one of the levels was I wanted to maybe do a documentary on all the stuff that I had collected from him. I mean, all the audio, the Skype recordings. I recorded all the Skype interviews on GoPro. I have, you know, and those will be coming out. I'm going to be premiering some of that video on Dr. Oz in September. And I actually just signed a deal for the rights to the book to make a documentary with a big company. And so that was what I had in mind. But the other thing was I didn't want to tell him because I didn't want him to come out and start saying he was raving. That was one of the reasons too, because he was itching to get some notoriety out of this. It really irked him that he couldn't take part in the notoriety of being Raven. Here he is on TV every week, national TV. I mean, international. Really, the show aired in, I don't know, 20 countries. So here he was, and he couldn't take credit for it. And for a serial killer not to be able to take credit for something is very, you know, that's a blow to their ego. You know, so
right.
So there were many different reasons why I didn't tell him right away.
You explore his early life. I've read other material, but you go into areas and get him to talk about areas that no one has ever. This is unprecedented territory, definitely. And you talk about, again, not making conclusions, but certain events and things in his background, his relationships with his father. Just tell us a little bit, give us a little glimpse of his early life and what you, I think, concluded to a certain degree on what was important in that triggering and his anger later.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you look at the whole picture of his childhood, his early adulthood, and his relationship with his dad, you see a picture emerge. You see a kind of a clear picture emerge of where the anger is deep-seated. If you ask him, he blames dad for everything, and he even says dad killed somebody and told him that story, and that made it okay, and dad got away with it, so that's how he learned. You know, I don't know about that story. I mean, you know, it's in the book, and it's in quotes from him, and, you know, there's no one else to dispute it, because by the time I got out to... was on my way out to talk to Les Jesperson, his father. He had died, he had passed, so I couldn't do that. But yeah, I mean, his childhood was one of, you know, he was the kid in the family that everybody kind of pushed around, according to him, that everybody kind of not only his siblings, but his dad and people at school kind of made fun of because of his size, kind of said, you know, you're dopey, you're stupid, you know, I think his brother started calling him Igor, and in school he was kind of ridiculed a little bit, and he was always to blame for everything, he told me, you know. He banged on about this a lot, that everybody blamed me for everything. My dad would lie and about things and put the blame on me. Always my fault, always my fault, always my fault. So, you know, what I look for as a when I put my clinical hat on and I start to look at stuff as a serial killer expert and researcher, I try to look for a couple of things in serial killers: addictions and sexual abuse. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out his addiction, because he wasn't addicted to drugs, he wasn't addicted to alcohol, any of that. And I'm like, there's got to be an addiction there, because all serial killers are addicted to something. Sex, I thought maybe it was sex for a while, and then bang, it comes late. Gambling. He admits to me that he had a gambling addiction. The sexual abuse, I could never get out of him, really, the idea that he was sexually abused. Jack Olson wrote a book called I, Creation of a Serial Killer, in which he talks about,
right,
about Jesperson, in which he talks about a neighbor kind of not necessarily sexually abusing him, but maybe, sexually confusing him, that sort of thing. But I didn't find no real outwardly sexual abuse. But the one thing that stood out in all of it, to me, was really sobering in many ways, and he didn't really want to get too deep into it. He wrote me a manifesto at one time of his life, from the 1800s up until the day his last murder. And what I mean by manifesto is this was different from the letters. He took three thick 250-page notebooks, and he wrote out his whole life for me. And in all those 700 pages or whatever they were in that particular manifesto, I think he mentioned his mother once. And I asked him, I said, do you realize you mentioned your mother once in this whole thing? And I said, that's very telling to me. Why? And he didn't have an answer for it. So I believe there's something deep-seated there between him and his mom. What it is, I don't know.
You also talk about his ex-wife, Rose, and
yeah,
he thought maybe this ex-wife was a focal point of his psychosis. Tell us a little bit about what he said about his ex-wife.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something there. I don't know if his story is 100% accurate, but
right,
what happens is, you know, they ultimately divorce, and the divorce is what sends him out of the house, sends him to go live with Roberta Ellis, another woman. And then Roberta takes off with a trucker while they're living together on him. But before he takes off with before he leaves the house from his divorce, you know, there's a couple years there where he doesn't have sex with his wife. He's not having any sex with his wife, and he talks about that as something that really bothered him, you know. And he talks about how Rose would say things to the nature of, you know, when he made an advance, she'd say, go stick it in a keyhole, something like that, or go masturbate, or something like that. And he didn't like that. He wasn't too particularly fond of that kind of talk. And he really developed some anger toward not only Rose, but women in general, I believe, from that. And so we have this guy who's now divorcing, but he's living there, and for the couple years there where he was having sex with his wife, he was getting prostitutes. And what he began to tell me was that he believed that Rose and other women, he didn't like it when they used him. And he said, most women will use men, most women would use me. And he really was angry about this. And then there's a connection between his first victim, Tanya Bennett, where he claims she makes an advance at him at the bar. He brings her home. They're there. And then he makes an advance at her, and she tells him, go stick it in a keyhole. And he said, that was it. I snapped, punched her, and I didn't stop. But if you look at all his victims, the way he described them to me, you'll see that in each one of the cases, he believes that woman used him in some way, and that was it. That was it for her.
We're going to use this as a break just to talk about our sponsor for this evening, which is ZipRecruiter. A friend of mine who listens to True Murder just messaged me about 4 weeks ago about his experience with ZipRecruiter. And he had just started his a company in the past 2 years, and they were doing quite well. It was a small company with staff he had assembled from years of working in the field. Now, he said he tried to hire just one more employee to round out his office. But over a certain period of time, he found it was reluctantly he could not find out and get the right employee for his company. So he decided to check out ZipRecruiter and decided that he loved their choice of resume formats and he loved their unique mobile apply process. And as promised, he got a lot of applicants right away. In the end, he found the employee he really wanted, and quite quickly. He called me to tell me the experience that he had with ZipRecruiter. Now, are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job, better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. One more time for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. You were talking with Happy Face Keith Jesperson, but at this time you... When he talked about the murder of Tonya Bennett, he also went on to justify why these other murders happened, and he also talked about, as you describe in the book, how murder got easier, and as you describe, how his murders got more brutal and more sadomasochistic. So tell us some of the revealing conversations that he begins to convey to you.
Yeah, this is, you know, and this is a bit, this gets into a bit of where I begin to break down, as you saw or read in the book. Throughout this process, I begin to experience bouts with anxiety that put me in the ER. I begin to experience, you know, sleepless nights. I begin to get on some medication. A lot of things start happening to me physically, spiritually, psychologically, and it's all because of this. I mean, there's no other reason. It starts to work on me, and I don't even realize it, really. Going back to the metaphor of the water, I'm kind of used to it. And in one of those instances, it's Angela Sabreez. Angela Sabreez was victim number 6 or 7, I believe. And with Angela Sabreez, I asked him, you know, I said, listen, this story about you tying Angela Sabreez to the bottom of your truck and dragging her down the highway for 12 miles, I said, no one's really ever asked you, I might digress a minute and say I was amazed at the questions that were never asked of this guy and he, you know, by other journalists. So I asked him, I said, listen, I said, was she alive or was she dead when you tied her underneath that truck? And he started laughing. He said, it would make a much better story for you if she was alive, but I think she was dead. And he would chuckle, you know. And I'd say, what are you talking about? I mean, what do you mean? What are you trying to say? You know, are you trying to leave it ambiguous for me? And he's like, no, look, I think she was dead. And he'd laugh, you know? And so it was images like that of perhaps a woman still alive being dragged underneath a truck that would wake me up in the middle of the night, and I'd be staring at my ceiling thinking, oh, my God, what did this woman go through? What did any of these women go through? I mean, you know, he was the kind of killer that you said the wrong thing, and that was it. You had, if you were a woman, you had these hands around your throat, and he was strangling you to death, and he was looking at you in the eyes, staring into your face. You know, bitch, you should have never said that. You know, why did you say that? And he would justify it by blaming the victim. He would talk about karma. It was always karma. These women crossed my path. They were meant to die. I was meant to kill them. You know, that sort of stuff. And that sort of stuff really began to bother me, you know, because I know it's all bullshit. That's what I know. You know, this guy is a psychopath. And psychopaths, they don't care. I mean, they have no empathy. You know, they don't care, you know. If you cross their path and they want you dead, you're dead.
Now, during this five-year period, there becomes a point where you're not, for lack of term, you're not shying away from asking him hard questions. And, in fact, you're not shying away from condemning him and
right.
ridiculing him as a killer. I found that one of the most incredible parts of this exchange between you two. What are the kind of things that you finally, in frustration, after hearing so much of, like you called some as ridiculousness and just on and on and on, what are the kinds of things you finally say to him in this kind of confrontation, and what's his response back?
Well, again, we talked about Angela Sabreez many times, and I would say, one time I said to him, I said, you know, was she alive or was she dead? It's a simple question. And he says to me, what kind of person do you think I am? I said, what? What do you mean, what kind of person do I think you are? What he was saying was, you know, you don't think I'd tie an alive person underneath my truck, do you? And I said to him, you are an effing serial killer. So all bets off, dude. Anything is possible with you. That's a fair question. And I would hang up the phone. I would hang up the phone. And he'd call back a couple days, and he'd say, listen, I'm sorry. And I'd say, listen, man, you know, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this. I'm not going to sit here and get angry with you on the phone, you know, and hang up on you. That's not the way this is going to work, you know. He had no trouble answering questions as long as the question didn't challenge him in a way that he felt betrayed a confidence between us, you know. So as long as he felt that his narcissism and his ego could blossom during the answer, he was fine. But when I hit him hard, you know, he'd get mad. He'd get mad.
To describe, I guess, just to basically in one short story, basically encapsulate what Jesperson was all about, you talk about the woman that he had known previously before that he picks up again at a truck stop. Tell us a little bit about this, because it does illustrate most dramatically the character of Jesperson.
You're spot on with that, Dan. Julie Winningham. He picks her up, and I believe they go even visit her mom. He had dated her before, you know, or went out with her a few times. They knew each other. So he picks her up on a Friday, I believe it is, and she's in the truck with him, and they're driving. And Julie's saying, you know, listen, man, listen, Jesperson, Keith, I got a court date Monday, and I'm going to get a DWI, and I'm going to get put in jail, and you got to get me out. You got to bail me out. And he said, I don't have to bail you out. I'm not bailing you out. That's, you know, that's your problem. And here we go with the with that trigger for him. The trigger for him was, you know, you're using me, right? That's the trigger. If he thinks he's being used by a woman, watch out. That's the switch that's going to flip. So she begins to really, really gnaw at him with this. You got to get me out of jail. You got to bail me out. Listen, we're going to be together. And she starts talking about let's get engaged, and she's talking about all this stuff, and he's like, he's just listening and listening and listening, and he's telling her, no, 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 and this is not how it's going to go. I'm going to tell you how it's going to go. You go to jail, then you're on your own. I got to take this load of steel across country. I can't be bothered with you. And she's like, you don't understand. You got to get me out of jail. And he goes, you know what? I got a way to get you out of jail. And he grabs her by the neck, and he brings her in the back of his cab, and he strangles her to death. And then he looks at her, and he says, now you're out of that court date. You don't have to worry about it anymore. And so so there it is. There's the psychopath. There's Happy Face, the killer, that he had had enough. He felt he was being used, and so this person had to die. That's his answer, death.
What does he – you talk about just a characteristic of Jesperson. After the killing – tell us about his eating and sleeping habits after that.
Yeah, I mean, in many instances, the guy would kill the woman, strangle her to death, which is one of the most personal ways you can kill somebody, is strangling them to death, because it doesn't come off like it does in the movies. It takes 4, 5, 6 minutes, even for a guy his size. It takes a long time to strangle somebody to death, and it's very personal. You're staring at them the whole time. He would strangle a woman, leave her in the cab, and one of his things was he'd like to go to Burger King or McDonald's and get some fries, a hamburger, and sit down and eat, and then come into the cab and push her aside and take a nap. Either dump her off on the side of the road or push her aside. In a couple instances, he took a nap right near the body. I mean, that exemplifies the type of person that he is. He's a psychopath. He does not care. That stuff does not bother him. In one instance, which actually I have a Skype video of him describing this. In one instance, he brings the cheeseburger back into the truck, and he even says to her, and when he was telling me this, he's laughing, and on film, I have it on film where he's laughing while he's describing the scene. He's like, I was telling her if she was a good girl, she could have had some of this burger, but she wasn't a good girl, and he laughed about it. So, you know, and that's type of stuff where, you know, I'm the journalist, I'm there, you know, and I'm like, I write in Dangerous Ground. I write, you know, objectivity. There's no such thing for a journalist. That's all bullshit. You can stay objective to a certain point, but objectivity. I'd be sick to my stomach when he would tell me stories like that, you know. And sometimes I would tell him. I would say, man, you know, you have no respect for the victims of your crimes, even now, later, after you've been arrested, and you need to show respect. You know, he almost never called them by their names. They were always victim 1, 2, 3, or it, or they. He would never personalize them.
Now, you say at this time, too, as you go through this incredible process, that you see this as a trade-off, that you need to continue with this for a higher goal than obviously just a television series or another book or journalism itself, the institution. You have a higher goal and objective in continuing to talk to him. So tell us how you do continue despite your incredible pain in your guts from talking to this guy. But what is your big goal? What would you like to do with this?
It's funny because, Dan, I had Dr. Catherine Ramsland. You might have had her on your show. She's
Absolutely.
Been on all the crime shows. She's written 50 books, I think. I had Catherine, who's a friend, read the manuscript for me for a comment, you know, for a blurb. And one of the things she asked me was, while she was halfway through, was, you know, why did you stay in this? Why would you stay in this if it's affecting you like that? Well, I'm going to go back to the metaphor that, you know, before you realize it, you have hypothermia in that cold water. And because you're used to the water at this point, you don't realize your body is cooling off, so you get hypothermia. So that is a metaphor. One of the things that kept me in this was he had a couple of cases that I was real interested in from the very get-go. One of them is a Jane Doe in Florida. And the Jane Doe in Florida is a woman who he picked up in Tampa. He strangles maybe 500 miles into the journey, 300 miles into the journey, and dumps her body along the I-10 on the panhandle in Florida. She's found a couple years later. When he's arrested, he admits to killing her, tells them all the information he can about her. Her name was Sue, Suzanne, Suzette. He doesn't really know, you know, where she was coming from, where she was heading, Lake Tahoe, Reno, that area, and, you know, that's about all I know. And for 20 years while he's in jail, Florida law enforcement is writing to him, and they're saying, can you help us? Because we can't identify her. We put her DNA into CODIS, into the databases, and nothing pops up. You know, and I'm a victim's advocate. I mean, murder's affected my family. And I'm thinking, this poor woman is a box of bones in a forensic lab in Florida. Her whole legacy is a number on a box. This woman needs to be in the ground, in the town where she's from, with her name on a tombstone, so her family members can memorialize her and think about her and remember her that way. And that kind of made me sad. It kind of drove me. And I said to myself, I said, I can maybe help here. Now, he would send me all the mail that he would get over the years. He sent me all the letters from Florida law enforcement, and he told me flat out, he said, I'm not helping them. And he said, you know, if I help them, what's going to happen is we identify her, her family comes forward, they want to press the case, I end up in court in Florida, and then I get the chair, and then I'm dead. And there's one thing serial killers do not like. Most serial killers that I've interviewed and I've written about, and I've written 7 books about, they're afraid of dying. They're afraid of death.
Yeah.
Serial killers have no trouble doling out death. But boy, you put it in their doorstep in front of their face and they get scared. So he was afraid that the family, you know, that he would end up. And so he's like, I'm not helping them. And the DA, nobody will give me immunity, you know, if I help. So I said to him, I said, well, let me see what I can do about that. And maybe me and you can work on it together. That'd be something we can do together. So I went behind his back, and I started talking to Florida. And I talked to them for, I don't know how long, a year, maybe 6 months, before he even knew. But to backtrack even more, after I told him that I was, let me see what I can do, I waited a couple months, and I got him on the phone one day. I said, listen, man, I spoke to the DA in Florida, and they gave me verbal confirmation that they looked me in the eye, they shook my hand, I said, we're not going to prosecute him for this case. We just want to identify the woman. And they gave me a guarantee that there's no way you'd be prosecuted for the case. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah, they guaranteed it. And at this time, I don't know, 4 years into our relationship, he trusts me 100%. My word is gospel to him. Whatever I say to him, he does, and he believes. And I lied. It was a lie. I never spoke to the prosecutor. I never spoke to anybody. And I'm like, what do I care if I lie? What do I care if he's prosecuted down there? I hope he is. So thus begins what Florida tried to do for 20 years. Now I'm able to facilitate. I'm able to facilitate him, who he's an artist at this point. He's become a really well-groomed, well-trained artist. I get him to start drawing a picture of her. He looked in her eyes. He strangled her to death. There's one thing serial killers, you know, don't forget, and that's their victims. Excuse me. So then I tell him, I said, listen, why don't I give Florida a call? Let me put you in contact with the forensic artist who's been trying to get a hold of you and trying to work with you. And he goes, yeah, do that. Knowing that I had been talking to these guys for 6 months already and kind of saying, listen, I'm going to get them to help you. What do you want? What questions? What can I ask them? And I had gotten all the reports, and I questioned him on everything and about this case, him not knowing that I had the reports, and his answers were, you know, he was telling the truth, according to reports. So I put it all together. I facilitated the whole thing and kind of acted as the liaison between the two, and we came up with a composite, a really great picture that he drew from memory, and then a composite made from her skull. And, boy, when we put the two together, they overlapped, they matched. So his memory in the skull matched. In the last trip I made down to Florida, really, Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, they actually gave me a replica of her skull, which sits on my desk, Jane Doe, an exact replica. And, yeah, because of all the work I did in that case. So that was kind of driving me a little bit, you know, that in another case. It was kind of driving me to, there could be some redemption in this whole madness for me, you know. There could be something good that comes out of this.
Exactly. Now, as we mentioned, this is part memoir, and it's also a very, very personal story, as we had spoken in the introduction. Tell us a little bit about your brother and addiction, as you do. You talk about your experiences as well, and the effect this addiction had on your family, and also about, of course, his murdered wife, Diane. Just tell us how on earth the Raven, Jesperson, helped you to come to grips with this very personal aspect of your life.
Yeah, I mean, that I appreciate the question. I mean, in many ways, there's a major part of this book that is an addiction memoir. I mean, my brother's addiction to heroin is there in the opening pages of the book, in the prologue. He's on methadone in those opening pages. My addiction to alcohol, my sobriety, Diane, my sister-in-law, her addiction with my brother to drugs, hard drugs, and how even my grandfather, whom I never met, his addiction to alcohol, and how he died, and how it all really manifests in our lives. And I got to say that if you're a writer and you write books for a living, whatever kind of books you do write, ultimately you're going to tell the story of your own life. It's going to happen. You're going to end up doing it. And for the life of me, I never for one minute ever thought that when I told my story and it stared back at me, what would happen. Because when you remember something, childhood trauma, a good memory, when you remember it in your head and you think about it, there's a narrative of it in your head, and there's pictures in your head. Everybody goes through that. But let me tell you something, Dan. You write it down on paper, and you begin to think about it in a different way. As I wrote in the author's note in the book, I didn't sit down and dredge up memories to write this book. What I did was, wherever I was at the time, and the memory came in to my head about something that I want to include in the book, I wrote it on my iPad or I wrote it on my iPhone. I just wrote notes about it. So I wasn't forcing myself to come up with memories as I sat down every morning to write. I didn't want to do that. A lot of times I would be in bed in the middle of the night, I'd wake up and I'd start writing about something. So through all of that, you know, Jesperson, while I'm writing that type of stuff, I didn't tell him about any of that stuff, but he kept asking, when am I going to help you with your sister-in-law's murder? And I'd be like, man, you know, let's just keep that out of it. You know, how can you possibly help me with her unsolved murder? And he said, well, I've been helping you with the Dark Minds cases. I mean, I don't know those cases until you give me the information. I could maybe help you with hers. And you know what? He was right. I mean, he didn't know any of these cases until I sent him the research to look at, and then he could analyze and comment on them. And so I broke down a little bit and kind of began to explain to him about her case and what our family went through and all of that. And he had a revelation. It really made a sobering point that because of the person she was, you know, we're talking 1996, she was murdered. I mean, here it is 21 years later, and, you know, every freaking year we hear the same thing from the state police and the prosecutors. Many of these people I know, I've written books about, and I know we hear the same thing. Oh, we're waiting for DNA. Well, you're waiting for DNA 20 years later? You waiting for Tess to come back? I mean, and he said, they're just telling you that, man. They don't care about your sister-in-law's case. Just like the girls I murdered. They don't care. They don't care. There's certain girls that they care about and certain they don't. And in the book, I kind of put a name on it. I call it the Natalie Holloway effect. So if you're a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white girl with a family who's got some money or whatever, and you go missing, well, Jesus, the satellite trucks are at your door and the case is everywhere. But if you're a Hispanic girl from, you know, Hartford, Connecticut or Worcester, or you're my sister-in-law from Hartford, and you're, you know, you're not the most upstanding citizen, forget it, man. There's nobody, no satellite trucks at your house helping you. And he made that point to me clear, and he was right.
Yeah. Now, when you talked about this book, a book possibly about this correspondence and a documentary, it's interesting, as you write, what he immediately does and sends you, just to show you how of his interest.
Yeah. That's great, isn't it? Yeah. So I tell him, you know, I'm going to do a documentary. I'm going to do a book. He kept asking me, and he's like, yeah, excellent. That's now you're speaking my language. And, you know, a week or two later, what do I get in the mail? I get this long letter, and he sketches the whole thing out. He sketches each chapter, what should be in each chapter, how it should go, what I should do. He sketches out the documentary. Oh, this is okay. This is what you need to interview. And he just tries to take control of the whole process. And yeah. I get him on the phone, and I'm like, dude, you're not writing this book. I'm writing a book about my experiences about you, Dark Minds. I made a promise to you about the Tonya Bennett case. That's going to be in it, and it's going to be about my life. This is not – you're not going to sketch out my book for me. And I kind of heard the air come out of his balloon a little bit. But he went along, you know, and he's like, okay, whatever you want to do, I'm behind.
Yeah. Now, you had to, and you speak about this in the book, inevitably breaking this communication with him. Tell us how you did that, or if you did that.
Yeah, I wish I could say that it's complete, but doing the media stuff, I've kind of kept him on the line. At a distance now. I speak to him maybe twice a month instead of three or four times a week, five, six times a week. So I speak to him maybe twice a month now. If I need him, I can leave him a voicemail, believe it or not. If I need, you know, suppose I need him tomorrow, I leave him a voicemail, he'll call me. But one of the interesting things was when I went out there for that last visit that I write about in the book was what I get in the mail after I come back from him. I get a certified, you know, letter, notarized. He's given me his body. He wants to see, you know, when he dies, he wants me to claim his body. And I'm like, I don't want your body. All I want is your brain. And that might sound bizarre, but I want to donate the brain to the research I talk about and I support that's in the book, the research that's going on in England by Adrian Raine, that psychopaths are born. So psychopaths are born. The part of the brain where you're supposed to have empathy, sympathy, is not there. So I'm hoping that he can at least do one of these good things and give us some scientific research from his brain in the end.
I just wanted to mention, too, you add the confessional letter, the would-be suicide note that he sends to his brother Bruce, which is just incredibly fascinating. I wanted to ask one last question. What, in summation, would you say was the most profound thing that you took away from this whole experience?
Oh, that, you know, that's a great question. I mean, the one thing that I confirmed is that people underestimate the word psychopath. They underestimate the lack of morality morality, sympathy, the lack of emotion. People underestimate the fact that a psychopath cannot love. They cannot love. And I experienced it for 5 years. I experienced that on basically a daily basis, that lack of empathy, that coldness, without the person trying to be that person. It's just who they are. It's not any fault of their own. It's not any – and look, that might sound bizarre. That might sound weird, but that's the truth. It's of no fault of their own. This is who they are, you know. And that was a revelation to me that, you know, that we want to blame the person, you know. And, yes, we can blame them for the murders they commit and stuff, but for being who they are, that's who they are. They can't change who they are.
Yeah, incredible. And as you write in this book, you've uncovered every scrap of information you could possibly could in this correspondence and your research over and beyond that to bring us the most complete portrait of one of the most frightening killers in American and all of true crime history. I want to thank you very much, M. William Phelps, Matthew, for coming on and talking about Dangerous Ground. For those that might want to look at your other work, do you have a website? Or you do have a website, Facebook page? Tell us how they might contact you or look at your other work.
Yeah, mwilliamphelps.com. That will put you in touch with my Facebook and at mwilliamphelps for Twitter. You can just Google M. William Phelps Facebook and get on my Facebook. Facebook is where I do most of my communicating with people, and I talk to fans all the time, so fans know me as someone who's always communicating with them. So, yeah, you can find all my stuff there.
And you talked about the documentary. Can you tell us the status of that so far?
Beginning stages of that, we're just signing a deal and getting started, and it's going to be comprehensive. It's going to involve something we didn't talk about, which is in the book, and that is, I believe, and I think I've proven, without a doubt, that one of the victims he's on the books for, Cynthia Rose, he did not kill, and a victim he did kill should still be buried where he put her. So that's going to be a major part of the documentary, I believe, is trying to find that woman. I know where she is, and to show that he did not kill this woman, Cynthia Rose.
Oh, incredible. Fantastic work, Matthew. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about Dangerous Ground, your friendship with a serial killer. Thank you very much.
Hey,
hope to talk to you again
always
soon.
Always a pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good night.